listener. To Darling Shine, a podcast by myself, Elodie Pullen,
and me, Chloe Fisher.
A place where we ground womanhood's unspoken experiences from grief to fertility and everything in between.
Join us while we transform our pain into power, encompassing all emotions, ugly and beautiful. Darling Shine is your chosen family and your survival kit for the unexpected shit life throws at you.
I'm very excited about this episode today. And as you would all know, if you follow Darling Shine, we always are talking about women's health. But today it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to be talking about male infertility. It's a topic I've been wanting to kind of cover for quite some time, but I just haven't found the person who I want to chat to about it with. And I am very lucky to have Dr. Shaheen Gadir. He's a fertility and reproductive specialist from Los Angeles. He's one of Hollywood's most recognized ones, actually. That's how I got in touch with him. He has an incredible podcast called The Fertile Life, and I actually love your Instagram for bite-sized nuggets of information. I learned so much. So hopefully today everyone's going to learn a little bit about male infertility with you. So welcome to Darling Shine.
Thank you so much for having me, Chloe. I was really excited about today.
Yay. So just a really quick little backstory about how we know each other. For those following my journey, you would know I had a surgery last year. And after the surgery, I was told that it potentially hadn't worked in some way, shape, or form. And I had been recommended to him by a really good friend of mine. And when I kind of got that news, I was in dire straits and I messaged him and I said, I need to see you. How do I get in? You got me in right away. Paul and I came and saw you, and your personality, your energy, everything about you, we just absolutely gravitated towards you. As soon as we walked out of your office as well, we were like, oh my God, this is our guy. Fast forward to now. We fortunately for us actually didn't need you because we are pregnant. But yeah, I'm so, so excited to have you here today. So where are you working now? Because when I saw you, you're not at the same place anymore, correct?
No. So after almost 18 years, I decided that I needed to move from my clinic. It was no longer the right place for me to be practicing medicine. So I am now at the Huntington Reproductive Center. I am in their West LA office. In 3 weeks, we are moving to our Beverly Hills location in preparation for one of the most state-of-the-art fertility clinics that's opening next year in the heart of Beverly Hills, where we're going to be practicing with one of the most advanced IVF labs on the West Coast of the United States.
Wow. Congratulations on that move. That sounds incredible.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well done. Well, hopefully I get to see you again one day, but I've still got frozen embryos in the States. So if I do have to use them, I'll be coming there. I'll be knocking on your door.
Not a problem.
But so today, most people know that a lot of the pressure when trying to conceive is put on the woman. And generally what happens is you try to conceive for X amount of time. It's not working. You go and see your doctor, you get told to do some testing, but it's mainly focused on the woman. It's never really too much at the start focused on the man. But when you think about it, 50% of the genetic makeup of a baby is from the man and 50% is from the woman. I'm not going to try and quote it. I'm going to ask you straight off the bat, what is the percentage of infertility cases that are actually male factor?
So a lot of research has shown that 50% is not male and female. It's about 40% male, 40% female. And sadly, we have this category called unexplained fertility, where we just don't know who's at fault or what's going on. And that's about 20%. So that division is about a 40-40. Years ago, it used to be that like they would say the female side was much higher and the male side was much lower. But we know for a fact now that it's about a 40-40. And every single decade, it looks like sperm issues keep on getting worse and worse. And maybe that aspect may change in the future. But for now, it's a really good solid 40-40%.
Wow. I'm surprised by that because I would have thought that potentially, and I don't know where I got that from, but I would have kind of assumed that the female it maybe came a little bit more heavier on the female side. But
because of everything that's been talked about over the years.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the media and the like just the societal pressures on the women when it comes to fertility. It's kind of sad, yeah?
It is sad.
So you've been doing this for a very long time. I want to talk about, and we just touched on it then, like sperm quality and health since you sort of started, and what you've seen has it's obviously decreased.
It has changed. First of all, our quality of examining sperm has gotten better. We are able to do DNA testing, not only just a simple semen analysis, which looks at volume and how the sperm is swimming, which is motility, and also the morphology, which is the normal look of the sperm, and the count, which is concentration. We now are able to look at what's called the sperm chromatin testing, which looks at the DNA quality behind the scenes. So we learn a lot more. But we've noticed that decade after decade, sperm quality has gone down, and it's almost it's almost like a universal thing where it's happening everywhere. We think that there are lots of things in our environment that continue to bring sperm quality down, and lifestyle as well, that kind of destroying the good quality of sperm as well. So it doesn't mean every single man's sperm is bad now, but when we're looking at small little nuances, we are noticing that there's more and more issues with male sperm factor affecting fertility on a regular basis.
And I know we're not talking about female, like I don't want to go down this avenue, but do you find that the egg quality is also dramatically decreasing too?
So the egg quality is dramatically decreasing because women are just waiting longer and longer and longer to get pregnant. Mm. And the longer they postpone, the more we're having issues. And we are really pushing, and I do my job to kind of educate the world and whoever's following along, to be very honest and clear about the fact that women need to freeze their eggs at a younger age, because no one's coming in anymore in their early 20s or trying to have kids like they used to. Some people are, not a lot of people. And because this social environment of careers and everything has changed so much drastically for women, that women are waiting. And the one thing that happens that we know for a fact is sometime around the age of 26, 27, 28, sometimes earlier, sometimes a little later, female egg quality starts to go down as well.
Mm. It's actually funny you say that, because when I first sort of started seeing my fertility specialist, I think I was 28, the first question he asked me was, how many children do you want? Because there's no point of like only getting one to freeze. We need to sort of like freeze a few extra. And I mean, luckily in my case, I was able to freeze a few extra, because my egg count dramatically dropped from 28 to 30. I think my last round of IVF was when I was 31. So last year or the year before, and I got zero eggs that last round.
So you have a good doctor. Very few doctors ask an overall question of how many children you want to have. So
really?
That's an extremely important question I ask everyone, because it's very different when you see someone who is 34 years old and tells you they just want one child versus four kids. Mm-hmm. The things that you have to offer and the things that you recommend for them to do are very different. If you don't have something on ice for baby number two, maybe for sure three and four, you're going to have a really hard time. So that's a very good question. And I'm so glad that you are knowledgeable on this topic of what happened to your own body in two and a half years, mm-hmm. and be able to discuss this with women, because I sometimes feel that just women just don't believe when I'm telling them that they're having a decline. When you're 26 years old, you just feel so amazing and so young and healthy that nothing anyone tells you is going to even dent your head for 1 second and your thought process about your fertility in any way.
And I totally agree, because until I started looking into it and I wasn't falling pregnant, I would have had zero clue. Like I literally would have had no idea. And then when I sort of started, and the only reason why I know so much about it is because we've gone through so much, but yeah, it's crazy. But even when the doctor is asking you about that, the how many kids do you want? I felt so many times was like, well, I just want one right now. Stop making me freeze more. But now, sitting here 4 years later, I'm thinking, thank God you made me do that, because, you know, this baby isn't the biggest miracle. Like, I don't even know how it happened, but we want more children. So, you know, I'm going to be 33 by the time I have this baby. And what happens if we want another one and we can't fall pregnant? And then, you know, I'm trying to do IVF later down the track and I'm literally not getting any eggs. So I'm grateful.
Well, so many women answer that question the same way that you do. And they're like, I'll just take one. And so then I rephrase and say, in a perfect world, how many kids do you really want to have?
Yeah.
Because that's my goal for them, is in that perfect world. But just saying one, you have to be careful about that answer. Because if you actually really do want one and your doctor thinks you only want one and doesn't do all the things to cryopreserve and help you have something put aside for the future, it can be very devastating.
Yeah, it's so true. It's just scary. I would never have thought that, like, at 33, you even have to think about this stuff. But I guess it's so real and it is so common these days. And I just urge women and men just to be across their fertility and be proactive with just looking into it. Back to sperm health. We're going to go into a lot of, like, things that can help with it, but I want to talk about what are the most common causes of male infertility.
I think the most common cause of male infertility is probably going to be a finding where the veins get thickened. It's called the varicocele. Mm. Varicoceles are very common, and they bring extra blood to the testicle, and blood is warm. That extra heat and those testicles bathing in more blood than normal and more blood flow around them makes them hotter, and that leads to damage of the sperm. So a varicocele is one that's very, very common that happens naturally without your control. Under your own control, some of the most important things that people do that is damaging their sperm immediately is smoking. Mm-hmm. And drugs. Drinking, I think, in moderation, to be honest, I don't think it's going to affect your sperm in a negative way, but then again, in moderation. Mm-hmm. So anything that takes, and then there's things that you're doing without even knowing. So jacuzzis, steam rooms, saunas, things that put a lot of pressure, like super tight underwear or super tight clothing that decrease the blood flow and the breathability of your testicles. The testicles are in a location for a specific reason, to stay cool, to be able to breathe, to not be compressed. So when you're doing all of these things, like the extra tight underwear and clothing and skinny jeans and all of these things, they're not that good for you, especially when done in excess. And then the temperature, there's a reason that we want the testicles to be a temperature to two, a degree or two cooler than your body, because that's the when they thrive and do the best. So that's a really important thing to be aware of as well.
And is it something that men can do to be proactive in checking their sperm health? Because, you know, with women, we can go get our AMH tested and check on our eggs and all that.
Absolutely. 100%. So women have to do a little bit more invasive testing with blood tests, with ultrasounds that are vaginal. Mm-hmm. A man has to give sperm. So the man does a semen analysis, rather easy to do a collection and get a result back within a couple of days that gives you really good understanding of the sperm well-being. There's really not that much more that you can do other than doing a sperm sample.
Mm-hmm. And do you go to your GP to do that, or do you have to see an actual fertility specialist?
It really depends. Most general practitioners have nothing to do with sperm and don't know how to do sperm analysis. Some laboratories do. I think the best place to do it is probably going to be a reproductive medicine doctor, mm-hmm. like a fertility specialist like myself, or a urologist that specializes in male fertility.
Why do you think it is that men aren't so proactive in checking their sperm health?
Well, I think that for many reasons, no one wants to be given bad news, and maybe there's the fear. A lot of the machismo in men, when they don't believe it's them and it's going to be the woman, you know, kind of keeps them from wanting to do these tests. Also, it is a little bit uncomfortable to have to go into a place that you're not familiar with and have to do a masturbation sperm collection in a room where there's probably people walking by. And it's just probably an uncomfortable thing. I've gotten desensitized to this. To me, it's go collect the sperm sample and you're good to go. But for many people who have never done this before and have nothing to do with it, I can understand why it is a little bit of a daunting process and they feel uncomfortable.
It's actually funny you said that, because Paul, I remember once when he had to go do a semen analysis, one of the women working in the clinic was like, "Fisher, I love your music. I just went to your show last, you know," and he was like, "Oh my God, this is so embarrassing." But it's not obviously embarrassing. It's just something that you got to do. But he was having a laugh about that.
Well, I want to address that. First of all, that's funny that someone says that, because usually people are, you know, he's taken as a compliment, a big compliment. But I think that some of that stigma of the embarrassment that came along with potential fertility treatment, thank God, has gone away. Mm. It has not gone away completely. And in some parts of the world, it's still very present. But I want to say, for example, here in the United States and probably in Australia as well, being proactive about your fertility, wanting to freeze your eggs, freeze your sperm, make your embryos, and be proactive in doing IVF, I don't think is that big of a stigma like it was before. Mm. I actually think it shows that you're intelligent, you're resourceful, you can afford it. So in many ways, I don't think that those stigmas that were there in the past are there as much now. So thank God for saying that. I think when you're, you know, recognized and you're a public figure, it's a little different. But we used to make sure in our current practice
that doesn't happen.
We're very, very, very careful not to give that extra attention that people don't really want to get in that way, in that place.
Mm, I think he kind of just laughed it off, but I can imagine some people would find that like pretty intense. But you just spoke of being able to afford it. It's obviously different pricing in Australia and in the United States. But in the United States, how much is it costing to get a semen analysis?
Around $150 or $160. Yeah, roughly. I'm not sure what it is in Australia.
Oh, it's cheaper than checking your eggs.
Yeah, it's definitely cheaper. Yes.
Okay, so the man has gone in, he's had his semen checked. When you get the report back, what are the things that you're looking at?
So when we're doing an official semen analysis, it looks at a couple different parameters. The first one is the volume, which is the amount of the ejaculation. And to be honest, this is the least important of all of the parameters that we look at. There are moments when men have a much larger ejaculation than others. In our bathroom and collection rooms, it's probably not the place where they have the highest amount of ejaculation. But at the same time, we don't want someone to hold off for like 2 weeks before collecting as well, because we give a parameter of 2 to 5 days. And we don't want people to be having sex the night before, because then volume can go down and counts can go down. And we don't want people to wait for more than 5 days, because sperm that's just sitting there starts to go down in quality. So 2 to 5 days of abstinence, the first thing we look at is the amount of the ejaculation, which is the volume. The second thing that we look at that is probably very important is the count. It's called concentration, and we look at that per milliliter. So usually we like that count to be over 20 million per milliliter, to be in the normal range. Some people are over 100 million per milliliter. So those are really great numbers for us to have there. The next one is motility. The motility is how well a sperm is swimming. So we want progressive motility that goes kind of forward and not backwards and not in circles. So progressive motility over 50% is considered to be excellent and good. And then the final one is the quality of the sperm. The word morphology looks at the head, the neck, and the tail. So morphology is how we look at the normal looking sperm. And the more normal looking sperm there is, the better the sperm quality. And there's different percentages for different kinds of calculations. So different organizations have different ones. The one that we use is 14% or more. Need to be normal to be considered average.
Yep. You speak of ejaculation, and I know it's different when you're doing fertility treatments and you're doing these semen analyses, but just in general, how often should men be ejaculating? Because obviously you don't want your sperm. Do your sperm go stale?
It's a good question. So there have actually been research that has been done that has shown that men that ejaculate regularly have better quality sperm than men that ejaculate very rarely. And so I've been asked this question many times. So, you know, like many times a day better, and that's not true. So when we say regularly, we mean every day or every other day, not necessarily 5 times a day, but basically every day or every other day is considered to be regular ejaculation.
Every day. Holy shit.
Every day or every other day is considered to be regular ejaculation. Now, it doesn't have to be with intercourse. It could be with whatever method, but that's
Busy boys.
Yeah. Well, got to do what you got to do. So those are... that has been shown in research, documented, that helps sperm improve quality because it's regularly being produced and regularly being ejaculated.
And when you're trying to conceive around that conception, the ovulation window, you're not wanting people to have sex every day though, right?
So we are. Research has shown, and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine said that, like, around the ovulation predictor kit turning positive, so around day 12, 13, 14, if you want to have sex every day or every other day, you're good.
Yeah.
There's no research showed that every day was better than every other day.
Okay. Okay. It's just better pinpointing the day. Okay, my next question. So when they're getting these results back, what are the sort of the next steps for someone who has kind of, you know, low morphology or low sperm count? Like, what, how can they kind of start improving?
Lifestyle changes are the first thing that I tell people about. So if you're doing steam rooms, jacuzzis, saunas, you know, you're doing tons of cycling or spinning, those are the first things that you need to modify for lifestyle.
Yeah.
All of, like, the clothing issues and things like that as well. And then you got to start becoming healthy. So foods that are rich in antioxidants, that have a lot of amino acids, that have a lot of proteins, like nuts, legumes, green leafy vegetables, you know, these are all things that are excellent for sperm. Okay. That help sperm quality and can help the entire basis of how sperm grows. In my opinion, that I think a well-balanced diet, and I love to always recommend the Mediterranean diet because I think that that's probably one of the healthiest diets that's available in the world. We know that it has healthy things in it, like avocados and olive oil and starches and carbohydrates and proteins and vegetables and fruits. I think is the best way to get a little bit of all of this into your body. You know, if we do see some drastic issues, going to male supplements, there are some male supplements. Naturally Smart for Men is a brand that I particularly like. It's actually 6 pills a day.
Whoa.
It's a lot, but it has a lot of proteins and a lot of amino acids that are required. And we tell people at that point to kind of just maybe take 3 with breakfast, 3 with dinner, or 2 with breakfast, lunch, and dinner to add up to the 6. But most people kind of figure out how to do it. And then there's also an antioxidant called CoQ10 or COQ10. And male specialists have shown in research that men that take 200 milligrams a day actually have better quality sperm that is less oxidatively damaged and therefore better quality. Women are supposed to take 600 milligrams, men 200 to help the sperm quality.
Yeah, I was taking that.
There's other things too, such as weight loss. So obesity is also very, very bad for sperm quality for multiple reasons. One is physically, a man that is overweight, their thighs and their legs get thicker and their testicles get compressed where there's a lot of heat around them all the time. Secondly, there is actually fat on a man's body converts to estrogen, not testosterone. So excess estrogen is actually bad for male sperm well-being, and testosterone is good, but natural testosterone. So anyone who is considering, and this is something that I'm saying this loud and clear, taking testosterone supplements or androgens to build muscle or making you feel better as a man will turn your sperm production off to zero.
Wow.
And you do not want to take that if you are going to be trying to get pregnant. So when your brain gets a signal, there's a lot of testosterone around, I don't have to produce anymore, the sperm production goes to zero. However, building your own male testosterone levels up, which grow up usually with muscle mass, is a great way to naturally boost your own testosterone levels, giving more of a fuel for better sperm quality. So fat is bad for men. Muscle is good for men. Muscle builds testosterone. Fat builds estrogen, which is the opposite of testosterone.
Wow, that's really interesting because I feel like it's such a common thing at the moment with men doing all these like supplements and injections and all that sort of stuff.
It is so common, and I can't tell you how many men come into my clinic. They're like, oh my God, I started it on this and my doctor never told me that my sperm count's going to go to zero and we can't get pregnant. Because after your body gets used to it, it's very, very hard to come off of it.
Yeah, because is it different? So the testosterone that you produce naturally is completely different to the testosterone that you're actually injecting, well, they're injecting.
Completely, yes.
Right, wow. Going back to supplements, you recommended one that, is it something that you sort of start taking as soon as you are trying to conceive, just like a woman takes prenatals?
Generally speaking, a prenatal is one a day or two a day or three a day at the most. You know, six pills a day is a lot. I'd rather know that my sperm had a problem before taking six unnecessary pills a day.
Right.
If it were me.
Yeah.
So I would rather do a sperm analysis and see if I need it and then take it. But if you know for a fact that your sperm has a problem, then I would take it for sure.
So other than the CoQ10 tablets, 200 milligrams a day, is there any other supplements that you would recommend men to be taking when they're trying to conceive and to try and improve their sperm quality?
There are quite a few fertility aid supplements for men that are made up of a lot of different amino acids. A very common one is like L-carnitine. I think when you're trying to put the concoction together yourself as a layperson, it's probably very difficult and unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And I think taking one of the male supplements out there that has everything in it together is probably much smarter and easier.
Okay, good to know. Once you sort of start implementing these changes, how long does it generally take to improve your sperm?
A cycle of sperm production takes 72 to 90 days. Basically speaking, any man in 3 months can generate new sperm. So right now that you're listening to this podcast, 3 months from now, you're going to have all new sperm. So you have a great opportunity of a quick lifestyle change and becoming extremely healthy to get really good sperm on the books.
You know how women's egg count decreases over time as you get older? Is it the same with men's sperm? Your sperm count kind of decreases over time?
So women are born with all the eggs they're ever going to have in their body.
Yeah.
From the day that they are born, and they are never going to produce new eggs ever. Men continuously until the day that they die produce sperm. However, studies have shown that after the age of 40, sperm quality begins to go down.
Right.
And there are issues with the sperm well-being. So it's not as amazing as it was when you're younger. But to the day that you die in your 90s, you're still going to have sperm being produced.
Okay. And okay, so we've spoken about the food and sort of lifestyle habits. What about an alcohol? What about if men are having a couple of glasses of wine or some beers during the week? Like, can you still drink a few drinks during the week, or you should be cutting that out completely?
I think a few drinks during the week, I tell people one or two drinks once or twice a week, you're totally fine. I mean, if it's starting to go into like daily drinking or two or three drinks a day or three or four drinks at a time, I think that's when you start to have a lot of problems, especially because the liver is the powerhouse, generally speaking, for your sex hormones. So that's another reason why the alcohol is not so great for men.
What about caffeine?
I think caffeine is one to moderate as well. There's been no clear-cut explanation of excessive caffeine intake. But I just think for your body in general, once you start going over two caffeinated beverages or three caffeinated beverages a day, it starts to take a toll on many different aspects of your entire body.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't recommend more than that at all for anyone. But there's no clear relationship between caffeine, though, and sperm well-being.
And what about eggs? It's sort of similar for female fertility as well, right?
Well, when it comes to caffeine, it's actually a little bit different. It's not the effect that it has on its eggs, but if you're doing excessive caffeine intake while you're pregnant, it can actually cause a miscarriage.
Interesting.
So that's why for pregnancy, we say maximum one caffeinated beverage a day.
Okay, good to know. I don't really drink coffee, so that's good for me. I had one more question before we get into the listener questions. I've heard this for the female side as well. When I share my story a lot, and a lot of people like fragrances, you shouldn't be using them. What are your thoughts on that for both male and female? Is it affecting you or not really enough?
I haven't really seen any real research on that in the medical literature, but I think that just in general, I try to live in the motto of like everything in moderation. Like if you have a special event and one night you put two sprays of perfume on you, you're fine. I mean, if you're going to start living in fear of things like that, I got to be very honest. I think it starts to take over at a higher level, mentally, emotionally, and then it starts to affect you in a negative way, much more than that actual scent of the perfume actually does.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of what happened to me in the end. After 4 years of everything that I had gone through, I was listening to every single thing that every person was saying. It was the fragrance thing. It was the nail polish. It was like, where do you draw the line? You can literally send yourself crazy.
I agree with that. And that's why I think the power of the mind is extremely important, especially for fertility patients, and especially for people knowing and having the knowledge and control over themselves. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I know. It's the mind is so powerful, I think, and especially when you start doing fertility treatments, and I feel like anyone else that's going through it would completely agree with me. It's like, that's the hardest part to control.
Very hard.
Now, I actually put this out there to our community, and so many of our listeners were very, very, very excited that we were speaking about male fertility today. And so I've kind of got like a list of questions that these listeners have wanting to ask you. So are you okay with me to fire away some questions?
Absolutely. Yep. I love that.
There's actually a big clump of them that, like, you're probably going to have a laugh, but like in association with drugs and drug taking. Number one question, and I know you already said it at the start, smoking weed affecting sperm?
Yes, 100%.
Do you think that that's the worst one?
I think that 100% smoking weed has been shown in research to affect sperm and egg quality.
Yeah. And another question I had was, does CBD and THC oil affect sperm health?
So there is very little data out there on all of the new components of weed that have been broken down. So I tell people, you're better to err on the side of being more conservative and not using any of those things to have better quality.
Okay. We sort of briefly touched on this before, but performance enhancing drugs are just an absolute no-no as well.
Absolute 100% no-no.
These are quick answers. The last, actually, there's two more in this sort of category, but do occasional recreational drugs affect fertility? So like, if, for example, this person said, what's once every 2 months or so, is this going to affect his sperm health? And I'm assuming they're talking about like ecstasy or cocaine or...
And I don't know what they're talking about. And there's probably not one research project in the world that ever said, okay, we're going to take 10 patients or 100 patients that do cocaine once every 2 weeks and or 2 months and do this. So it's very, very difficult to answer that question. But my better advice to that person who asked it is, why not try being as healthy as you can during the time that you're trying to conceive? Because probably having a kid is the biggest, most important aspect of people's lives that is out there.
Yeah, I know. And it's also like, you know, these sort of things aren't, they definitely are not helping you. So if you're actually serious about trying to conceive, it shouldn't even really be part of the question, I don't think.
For sure.
Would taking sleeping pills every night affect his fertility?
It's, again, a chemical. And again, it's a chemical that goes in the body. And is it going to affect every aspect of the body? There is no research that I know of that correlates sleeping pills and sperm quality, but I would not do that.
Next one was, is it a myth or can a hard knock to your balls destroy your sperm quality?
It's not a myth, and it's an organ. And it's an organ that's sitting right out there with a very minimal, minimal amount of protection over it. So a hard hit to your testicle that can cause internal bleeding, can damage blood pressure, blood flow and blood vessels to it, can definitely damage sperm quality.
Actually, speaking of the blood flow, you know, at the very beginning when you were talking about the vein, the most common cause is, what was it called?
The varicose seal.
Yeah. Is that something that they can see? Can you, like, without seeing a doctor, can you tell if you have this or no, it's an internal thing?
A varicose seal can be felt. So if you go to both sides of the scrotum and you're feeling down, if you go to the sides and you feel something that feels like spaghetti, that is thick. Because a normal blood vessel should not be felt like spaghetti going out from the sides of your testicles. There's ways of diagnosing it with testicular ultrasounds. we don't expect the layperson to be able to diagnose themselves, but if you're feeling things that definitely feel like spaghetti, it's definitely something that you should be talking to your doctor about.
Okay, that's good to know. Is male factor infertility, is that something that people or men are born with, or is that something that you develop over time?
It can be both. So if you're born without an undescended testicle and then they lower it later, some people's testicular function goes back to normal. Some never do. Some people, their genetics is just not going to give them great sperm. And some people, it's going to happen because of, you know, X, Y, and Z that they do to their body as they get older.
Yeah. And that's another, that was sort of the next question. If it is a, if it's something that you suffer from and it's a genetic thing, is it something that you should be speaking to your like male children about or not really?
I think so. I think it's very important for you to have open discussions about potentials for future issues for your kids.
Obviously, one in four women suffer miscarriages in their lifetime. Is sperm contributing to miscarriage?
Yes, it can. So if the sperm is giving an abnormal chromosome to the embryo that leads to the embryo miscarrying because it's not normal, then it's from the male.
Yep.
So it can absolutely be causing abnormalities and causing miscarriage.
Okay. And the next question that I had, someone said, if you do have a miscarriage, is it worthwhile doing DNA fragmentation test after that?
So I'm a little torn about the DNA fragmentation test because, you know, if you're doing everything you can to have better sperm quality anyways, mm-hmm. and improving your sperm quality and all of the testing that goes along with it, okay, I don't know what else you're going to know. Now, some people just want to know. So that's why they do the DNA fragmentation test, and I guess it's knowledge. So there's no downside to it, but what are you going to do if the DNA fragmentation is not that great? You're going to go get a sperm donor immediately? Probably not. I've over the years kind of ordered that test less and less because I find if you're going to do a test, but there's not much you can do about it, then there's really not that much reason to do that test.
We probably should actually explain what is a DNA fragmentation test though.
Absolutely. So the DNA fragmentation test, when we do a sperm analysis, everything is happening visually. When we do a DNA fragmentation test, it's basically as if you're doing a behind the scenes check on the sperm. It's not the count, it's not how well it's swimming, but this is now looking at the quality of what's going on inside of the sperm. And the more fragmented and damaged the sperm is, the more problematic it is.
Okay, and the next one that I have here is the impact of mobile phones in pockets. Should men not be carrying their phones in their pockets? I don't know where else they're going to carry them, but...
Oh, that's a good one. I don't think anyone really knows how to answer this question, but that is a personal pet peeve of mine. And since phones could be contributing to so many things, mm-hmm. and there is data about their magnetic waves, their electronic waves, and everything else that comes out of a phone, why risk it and keep it in that pocket? So I've just gotten used to putting my phone in my back pocket or in a jacket pocket or something and not necessarily my front pocket. And if I were trying to conceive, the last place I would put my phone is my front pocket. I am not 100% sure if that is valid or not, but it's a simple fix for me.
It does make sense though, I feel. Well, I mean, at least if they can move it from their front to the back, that's one step better. And the last question that I have from our listeners is, what are the odds of conceiving after a vasectomy reversal?
So there's different ways of conceiving after a vasectomy. One is to do a vasectomy reversal, but I think it really depends on the better route to know the age of the woman and how many kids you want to have. So if the female is also older and you may need to do IVF, then you can easily do what's called a testicular extraction of sperm, where they stick a special little needle in and just suction sperm out of the testicle from the vas deferens. I don't know if you necessarily need to do the vasectomy reversal. I think it's important to discuss. Now, if the wife is very young and you want to have multiple kids, that's a different story, or even very few kids. That's a very different story. It needs to be looked at case by case.
Okay.
If you are going to do a vasectomy, please freeze sperm first.
Men, if you're listening, I don't think we have too many male listeners, but this is definitely an episode that I want every single female listener to be passing on to one of their male friends, whether it be a partner, brother, friend. But, you know, I think it's so important to have this conversation. And I really think that this is probably one of my favorite conversations I've had on this podcast, because there's just so much that it's unspoken. I swear, like the male factor infertility is something that is not spoken about enough. We speak about so much about the female infertility being proactive, but it's just so important that both men and female are being proactive, and it's not just the woman's responsibility. It's often quite hard to have these conversations with your male partners. And what is the best way? Like, if you are a woman, you've had yourself checked, you've actually come up not, you know, in a bad place, and you suspect that it potentially could be your male partner that has male factor, how are you having this conversation with him to get his sperm checked?
Well, I would say that if you're able to have a child with someone, then you should be able to have a conversation with someone. Simple. Having a child and making decisions later on is going to be even much harder than this process right now of trying to get pregnant. So I think having an honest, straightforward discussion that is coming with love and explaining the reasons why science is there and why we need to do very smart testing to figure out that we're not wasting time or improve things that we can, I think is extremely, extremely important. And that's the angle that I would go for.
You should be able to have these open conversations with your partner if you do want to have children with them and that. But I just feel like it's such a stereotypical thing that you think that men are not going to take it, that conversation, as well as you would like to. I just have one more question for you. So is there anywhere, like, I know that there's definitely a lot of places for female support with infertility, because us as women speak about it a lot, but is there any places that men can go for support if it does fall on their side?
It's a really good question. And unfortunately, you know, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine is always a great resource, but I'm not sure of any particular exact places for men to go. I wish I did. Maybe it's something that we need to do.
Yeah, maybe I'll have a little research myself to put in our show notes, because, yeah, I feel like it would definitely be super helpful, because, you know, once you find out that you have these infertility issues, it's quite daunting, and, you know, you want support from others who have also gone through the same thing as well, because I feel like it's a little bit more comforting. This has been seriously such a great episode. I am so, so grateful that you've given me your time. I think that our audience are going to love it. And I just, you know, it's just so nice to speak about it from the male point of view, as opposed to always female, female, female. So thank you so much for giving me your time. And I really appreciate you coming on Darling Shine today.
It was an absolute pleasure. And I can't wait to hear great news about you and your future baby. And thank you again for having me on.
Thank you guys so much for listening to that episode. I just really want to stress how important it is to get this information out there. So if there's one thing that you do today, it's share this episode with any male that you know, whether it's a brother, it's a friend, it's your partner. I mean, you guys just listen to the episode. It's not that hard to improve your sperm quality. So let's try and get the message out there. Carly and I have done a bit of research, and we found some places where men can get help and can speak to other men should they get these results back that aren't as they would hope. So check the show notes. I've also put a link in there for Dr. Gadir's podcast and his Instagram as well. So I really hope you enjoyed that episode. I bloody loved recording it, and I will see you next week.